and welcome to yet another edition of Hunter Gatherers, the podcast of Hunter S. Thompson Stories. As always, broadcasting from our historic studios on Magazine Street in New Orleans, I'm Christopher Tidmore, and our host, coming to you from the coast of the great state of Maine, is...
Curtis Robinson, and it's good to hear your voice, Christopher, and we're recording this on a Friday, so happy Friday.
Happy Friday. You know, we've been looking back a lot to the sacred text of Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972, and I like to say, you know, the world has changed so much since 1972. A female member of the royal family is in scandal. Another was visiting America, and by the way, just so we know that there's an African-American challenger getting 4% in the presidential race. Oh, by the way, that sounds remarkably like today.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? As I say, and I'm going to have the tattoo done soon, that the thing about living a bit in Fear and Loathing and Campaign Trail 72 is the both depressing and encouraging similarities. In March of that campaign, a lot of the focus was on what we will call secondary candidates. In that case, of course, Shirley Chisholm. Is that how we pronounce her?
Chisholm, yes, Shirley Chisholm. The first African-American to effectively run for president, not to mention one of the first women to run in the 20th century, so...
She was the first woman elected to Congress.
Yes, she wasn't the first woman.
I remember the
first African American woman. Yeah, first African American woman elected to Congress.
First African American woman to be elected, and I think one of the things I remember. I mean, granted, in 1972, my major effort was not politics; it was getting the Tomahawk Elementary School Hawks past the Warfield Red Devils. However, I do remember in the 70s that she was just a big deal. I mean, I guess her equivalent to this, I see that, and I see the polling more and more with former President Trump and the black vote. And then I see her, and I mean, I guess the parallel to her would be Cornel West now, who I see polling at about 4% here and there, particularly in states like Georgia. That's going to be a lot. And do you grant those parallels still the same to you?
Well, and I think they're parallels. There were actual questions as to whether Shirley Chisholm would run as a third party candidate. We've got to remember there is one major difference between 72 and now. For all the parallels, effectively both presidential primaries are finished, closed, done, period. Whereas the primaries were still going on, pretty much close to the convention. So at this point, Shirley Chisholm is running, trying to be an anti-war candidate, and McGovern is not crowned officially yet at this point. So there's really
That's one of the things that the conventions are. It's interesting that even her delegate count, even going into the Democratic convention, which I think was Miami in 72. I mean, in 72, it was in Miami. There was a movement on to stop McGovern, to throw him out by the Humphrey delegation, right up until till the very end, which seemed possible. And you'll notice that.
Who is their candidate? Do you remember that they were going to crown?
I think it was Muskie at that point in 72.
Hunter makes reference to it. It's Big John McKithen of Louisiana, the former governor of Louisiana.
Hunter's insight into that, I mean, Hunter's insight into the conventions themselves can be its own book and probably will be someday, but I find the parallels interesting, and I would call upon you to look. I mean, we should tell casual listeners that you are particularly qualified to speak to polling of black voters because you are, and if I get the title wrong, tell me, but you are executive editor?
Associate editor. So we don't have an
executive. Associate editor.
So Louisiana Weekly, which is one of the oldest continuous African-American newspapers in the country, I serve as co-associate editor, which is the editorial position of the paper, with a gentleman by the name of David Baker. And we have a publisher, and we have two associate editors essentially acting as executive editors.
But you've been there for decades.
I've just celebrated finished my 27th year in February. It'll be 28.
Why? Don't take this wrong, but take it from a good place. Why haven't they fired you?
Oh, they've tried so many times. I'm like a bad infection. I just come back and back and back.
You're like one of those guys that gets fired. I got fired from paper once and it just came in the next week and no one said anything.
Yeah, I call it the French way of staying employed. They fire you, but it takes so long for them to fire you that you just sit at your desk long enough that they forget about it.
You just outlive it.
Yeah.
So
no.
From that vantage point and from doing probably 1,000 political endorsements over your career.
Yeah, I sat down at one point and tried to figure out how many endorsements I had written in the last three decades, and it actually came out to something like 1,800 people I've written endorsements for. So
if you assume that each campaign had four people you did not endorse who hate your guts, that's a lot of hatred.
Well, some of them come back around, so they get endorsed.
Oh, I see.
Some of them get endorsed and don't get endorsed the next time. So you play that the way you want. But
so the 4,000 haters drops maybe 3,500. I cling to that. Cling to that. So what do you make of the polling that tells us that either Trump is gaining in the black vote, particularly among black males, young black males, and that Biden has significantly lost support.
It's interesting. It's interesting you should be brought that I would, why haven't I been fired yet? Because the closest I ever came to be firing, not really, but I'm talking to our publisher, Renette Dejoire Hall, who you know very well, and she's a big Hunter fan as well. And the two of us are talking, and I said, the realistic chance that Trump is going to get somewhere in between 20% and 25% of the black male vote. It's interesting in the polling. His female black support is almost zero. It's in the point something range, but his black male support, at least if you believe the numbers, is about 20-25%. And my African American civil rights activist, brilliant publisher, after reacting with horror in the statement that I made of the stupidity as she thought I made it, did bring up, she said, well, considering how black women vote and black men don't, I'm not really worried, which was a pretty terribly bad statement. But the point I was making to her was, and I was using the 72 election as an example, part of the reason Shirley Chisholm is an interesting figure is African Americans were not necessarily a Democratic constituency for sure until the 72 election. And a lot of people are like, oh yeah, well, blacks have voted for Democrats since FDR. And I said, no, that's actually not really true. First of all, you start off with where most of African Americans lived. They couldn't vote anyway, or very, very, very few could throughout the former states of the Confederacy and below the Mason-Dixon line. But if you looked at African American vote up until Eisenhower, it was pretty divided. It started trending towards the Democrats and the New Deal, but it was still, Republicans still got it quite a bit. Eisenhower got a bit. And Republicans were the party of civil rights. And this is the point that's important to understand when understanding that where the black vote went and where it's going. Nixon was one of the big supporters of the Civil Rights Act of 57. I'm giving you this background to explain what's happening.
Richard Milhouse Nixon?
Richard Milhouse Nixon. We think of...
I was just making sure there wasn't another Nixon. So Richard Milhouse Nixon, our Nixon, Hunter's Nixon.
Hunter's Nixon.
Was for the Civil Rights Act in 57.
And in fact, he was rated by the NAACP as one of the highest civil rights supporters in all of the Congress in his time as a congressman and senator. And that wasn't so unusual. He was from California. It fit. And the Republicans were the party of the North. The Democrats were the party of the South. It kind of skews progressives' thinking today to understand that a lot of Democrats, could be left-wing on spending issues, infrastructure, and the New Deal, and be, what we would call right-wing on racial issues today. But he had supported it. He runs in 1960. He has the open support of Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson is not just endorsing him. He's campaigning for him all over the place. They're very good friends. The famous Martin Luther King letter that's supposed to sway it to JFK and the fact that Nixon didn't, it's not as clear cut in the 60 election. Nobody knows where the black vote's going to go. Nixon ends up with 25% of the black vote. And there's an interesting thing that happens with the Republicans, and his name is Barry Goldwater. And Barry Goldwater, he in some ways gets an unfair record from history in the sense that he had actually voted for several of the civil rights acts. but he opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 on the basis that you couldn't have a Civil Rights Act affecting private property, or at least that was his viewpoint, that as long as we're talking about government spending, you know, whether it's school boards and all this, fine, taxpayer money, you could be equivalent. You couldn't do that. That, of course, got him the attention of the South. But Barry Goldwater, people forget, was a much better politician than people remember. And he had a famous statement that he told Nixon in 68. He said, if you're going to go duck hunting, go hunting where the ducks are. And people are like, what does that mean? It was Barry Goldwater who started to understand the Southern strategy. But Nixon never ceased to be a civil rights supporter. You know, it's not like he turned on, he gave lip service to the Civil Rights Act of 64. So he didn't lose the black vote overnight. 18% had gone to him in the 68 election. It's the reason why he got 302 electoral votes, even though he only beat Hubert Humphrey by less than 0.75% in the vote. And so people, we're going to the 72 election, people are like, if he gets 20% of the black vote, you know, what states will be in play? Because remember, everybody thought this was going to be somebody who was going to be a Democratic moderate, somebody who's going to oppose it. And the McGovern phenomenon is just, okay, the party elders still have a lot of power, or at least they think they do. And so the black vote becomes a very big player. A lot of people are wondering, what do we do to keep African Americans in the Democratic coalition? Republicans, of course, are going to get almost 20% of the vote. And it turns out McGovern's great gift to the Democratic Party, he is the biggest electoral defeat of all time. His gift to the Democratic Party is he solidifies the African American vote as a Democratic constituency. No Republican from there on in would get more than about 11 or 12% of the black vote. And key state.
Was that mostly because of the war?
That was mostly because of the war. The Civil Rights Acts under Lyndon Johnson started. Hubert Humphrey is a major civil rights supporter, but the war is what basically solidifies the Democratic control of the African American vote. It stays that way. Now, an interesting thing is happening. Remember, I told you the black vote had shifted from the Republicans, the party of Lincoln, into the Democrats, and it didn't happen overnight. Each election, it got a little less, 40 for Eisenhower, 25 for Nixon, then 18, then 16. Trump picked up a historic high of the African-American vote, only by a couple of points when he ran for re-election, but that's part of the reason it was so close, because college-educated voters that had voted for him in 2016 did not vote for him in Philadelphia and particularly in Milwaukee the next time. African Americans in Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh did. To a listener,
well, I looked it up, and according to USA Today, in 2016, Trump got maybe 8% of the black vote, but then in 2020, that went up to 12%, which is about where I think he polls now.
He is, according to one estimate, he's polling about 15. I think it's a little high. I think 12 is probably closer to what the actual number is. Here's the wild card. It guts down to African-American men, about a quarter of them, are sympathetic to Trump. Will they go to the polls? African-American women always go to the polls, and they're not.
Well, that same poll showed that Biden's support, which was 87% in 2020, has dropped to 63, but,
yeah,
and I think this is a significant thing, 6% for RFK Jr. and 7% for Professor West.
And Cornel West is the interesting part of this. And one thing I have yet to completely understand the full story. Cornel West was going to pursue the Green Party nomination. And there was always some tension there. African Americans are not commonly Green Party supporters. One thing people don't understand is that there's a reason why the great writer who's not named our favorite writer on the show once put it that I believe belonged to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat because different Democratic constituencies have problems with other Democratic constituencies, and the black vote has always had problem with the environmentalist vote and with the LGBTQ vote. And because they have different priorities on, you know, African-American voters are on labor issues and civil rights issues, green voters on environmental issues and regulatory issues. And so Cornel West was pursuing that, but he was pursuing it because he wanted ballot access. The problem Cornel West has right now is, will he be on the ballot in enough swing states to make a difference? And it's pursuing it. RFK Jr. will, but it's cost almost $30 million just to get him where he is on 8 state ballots. And he's got
because Democrats and Republicans have carved up the country. That's what gerrymandering is. That we don't have time to deal with that before the next election. But that is the disease, and a lot of the other things are symptoms. But, you know, and I know we have said that before here. We have said this before here, that the parallels between, and parallel might be the wrong word, equivalency certainly would be, but let's just say comparisons between Wallace and Trump. We're not the first to say it, but it's uncanny. For instance,
It is.
Fear and loathing on the campaign trail. This is from April. And I'll read from it. Said, this is when he's going to his first Wallace rally. He said, I get there at 4:30 thinking to get in ahead of the crowd and maybe chat a bit with some of the early arrivals. But at 4:30, the hall was already packed and the bar was so crowded I could barely reach in to get a beer. Later, he says, for the next 2 hours, I was locked in a friendly, free-willing conversation with about 6 of my hosts who didn't mind telling me that they were there because George Wallace was the most important man in America. Quote, this guy is the real thing, one of them said. I never cared anything about politics before, but Wallace ain't the same as the others. He doesn't sneak around the bush. He just comes right out and says it. It was the first time I'd ever seen Wallace in person. There were no seats in the hall. Everybody was standing. The air was electric even before he started talking. By the time he was 5 or 6 minutes into his spiel, I had a sense that the bastard had somehow levitated himself and was hovering over us. It reminded me of a Janis Joplin concert. Anyone who doubts the Wallace appeal should go out and catch his act sometime. He jerked the crowd in Serb Hall around like he had them all on wires. They were laughing, shouting, whacking each other on the back. It was a flat-out fire and brimstone performance. Now,
You could have just described a Trump rally almost precisely.
I only recently saw extended footage of a Trump rally that wasn't, you know, news clips or something after just extended coverage. And anyone who's been to a good Southern tent revival will see the patterns. It was fired up. And I just think that the George Wallace, the way he could tap into that in the same way, I think is extremely interesting. And remember that this, he's writing, the reason Wallace started getting so much attention is he had won 3 primaries. He won Florida. And also, not for nothing, when he won Florida and his fellow Democrats, he did not run as an independent despite what Wiki says, they sort of denounced that. And of course, the millions of Florida voters who had supported him didn't appreciate that much. Does that sound familiar?
It sounds familiar, Wallace was the gateway drug for Southerners to eventually become Republicans under Reagan. But what's interesting to understand is, you remember in 68, he wins the South. I mean, he wins their electoral votes in the general election. And so he's coming back to take over the Democratic Party. It's almost as if Trump had run as an independent and then came into the Republican Party. We skipped a step there. Trump went straight into it. But our party structures are a lot more open than they were in 72 on both sides. The interesting part about Wallace is, Wallace is the first candidate who's winning the white vote across the board. So what do I mean by that? White ethnic voters had, Irish, the Irish Democrat and all this. Wallace is taking this coalition, understanding ethnic voters, and they're putting together with what were white conservatives, and they're creating a new coalition. That's at a time when Caucasians constituted 84% of the population. Now they constitute 60-some-odd percent. the interesting part about Trump is, and where we bring it back to Shirley Chisholm is, second-generation Hispanics and African-American males are responding much the same way as whites do, at least large enough percentages to make a difference. The way I explain this is a couple weeks ago, as you know, Curtis, I was in Colorado Springs, and I heard a guy, you know, who was sitting across from me at breakfast, well-dressed, professional, and he's saying to his colleague, you know, Donald Trump is the greatest president that America's ever had. And I turned to him, I said, but Juan... And you didn't even get that joke, but all right. The point it was that bad. It was that bad. But the point is, it actually was true. That Trump's appeal, that emotional appeal, what my radio partner in New Orleans, Hi McHenry, calls the willingness to fight, that he'll at least fight for us, is the same appeal Wallace had, and it's starting to cut across racial lines, and it's actually turning African-Americans, at least a minority, but a large minority of African-American males, into a swing constituency from the first time since the 1950s. And that has tremendous implications. And so as Shirley Chisholm's race ended up being a bellwether for blacks becoming a permanent Democratic constituency, I would say Cornell's race as an independent is a bellwether for African-Americans becoming a swing vote again.
That's interesting. It's so you think it could be more than a polling blip? You think it could be a sign of a new, a different dynamic, really?
Well,
that tracks back to 72.
Well, and what I wrote a column, and it's interesting because it had nothing to do with Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Fear and Loathing in the Campaign Trail 72. I keep saying Las Vegas. I don't know why. It's one of those days because I was reading Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas the other day for the 27th time.
There's always something new.
It's amazing. But one of the things I was remembering is in 1999, I wrote a column, and the column postulated that African Americans had the same voting patterns as every other large immigrant group that came into America, with a difference, one major difference. You have to calculate the day that they arrived in America as the day the 1964 Civil Rights Act passed. If you did that and you said that's the day the largest group was enfranchised and that's the day that they consciously embraced the American spirit, what happens? Well, most immigrant groups tend to identify with one political party over another. Irish were Democrats, so on and so forth. Different groups identify with different political parties. My point was, if you go, you have to have two things that change a political party dynamic. One, you have to have at least three generations of voting. And the second part, and I said it very bluntly, is you have to have a member of the minority group in the White House. Jack Kennedy was the last time the Democrats won 90% of the Irish vote. Nixon is going to win the Irish vote in 72, ironically enough. African Americans went all the way with the Democrats to Obama, and an interesting phenomenon happened. You're now on the fifth generation of voting African Americans, effectively with Gen Z, since the Civil Rights Act. Because remember, you're enfranchising people that already were alive, so it's not like they were born in 64. And you've got a generation of young black men that are disaffected by a lot of their traditional leadership. And it's, what is the most effective way of rebellion? Because we're tending, these black male voters, we're tending to be younger. Well, they see a guy who's out there talking straight as it is. I mean, I'm no Trump supporter, but the one thing the guy doesn't have is a filter. And that's kind of refreshing in this politically correct environment of ours.
Yeah, Bill Maher, the TV host, makes that point all the time. He says it out loud.
I mean, it just he resembles many of the cultural figures, you know, in the urban world that actually are coming. And you're saying Trump resembles. I mean, think about how rappers speak, and I'm not talking about the culture. I'm talking about the street, and you're going to find that sort of tone is very similar to a Trump rally. There is. And you're watching this effect, and they're and then they see, what do they see as the black leadership? Kamala Harris. If you're a young black male, what do you have in common with a San Francisco lawyer?
That's a good point. That's a valid point.
I mean, just because they're both black doesn't mean you're the same. And there's this theory, and one thing that will irritate my publisher was when people tell her the black vote must do X. There's never been.
I have been in the room when that happened.
Yeah,
and you're right.
It's the black vote. There's no such thing as this overwhelming monolithic one voice, one thought vote. It's they're human beings like anybody else. And so my point about all of this was Cornel West's articulations and criticisms, while they may lead to different ideological or policy solutions than Trump's, sound like a lot of the criticisms when he's talking about the disaffected young black male as Trump sounds as coming from a different angle. And so my point about this is Shirley Chisholm awakens the black vote, particularly awakens black women, but awakens the black vote. And suddenly the black vote becomes a major player. They're the one constituency that's going to turn out overwhelmingly for McGovern. They're going to be loyal. They're going to come through the elections. They're going to ultimately culminate to where there you couldn't find an African-American who didn't vote for Obama in 2008. And I don't mean that culturally. It just became, that's probably the only time you've seen that level of monolithic turnout, except nothing seemed to change for some. On the other hand, African Americans are the fastest. They're the fastest growth in wealth. They're the fastest growth of the middle class. African Americans are the fastest growing constituency in the economy, more than any other single group. They're also amongst the poorest in the scales. This is my point. The black middle class and the black working class are two very different constituencies. The black middle class, like the rest of the educated middle class, is behind Biden. The black working class has the same gripes as a guy in Appalachia. And same emotions.
So the upside for Biden is that when we see him get angry, and I always cringe, but that temper and that willingness to fight, let's say, probably serves him well. But what's his move? What can he do to remove that? Because frankly, in these close states, he cannot afford to lose that many of the black vote.
If the polls are correct, the denigration of the black vote in Pennsylvania alone, if the election were held today, would mean that that Pennsylvania would go for Trump if nothing else changes from 2020. That's how critical it is. That state alone.
Yeah, but you have to be the ghost of elections future.
What's the move,
as they say?
Well, and the simple answer is, right now, he's got to do something that responds to African American men, and the funny thing is, Biden's singularly capable of speaking to the needs of a hurting generation of young men. He went through some terrible things in his own life that can relate. He knows what it's like to see his closest relatives, his wife and everything die. He knows what the challenge is that comes in. He was a poor kid from Scranton. He's not so removed from poverty. But at the same time, he's surrounded by people that don't know how to talk to working class people. Biden, here's the funny thing. If I were Biden, I'd turn to Trump and I'd say, and this is my answer to your question, I challenge you to 25 debates. I'm going to every urban area in the country, the top 25 urban areas. And I'm going to have a debate, and there can be debates on each different topic, but mostly in the economy. And we're going to go into black churches, we're going to go into urban areas, and we're going to go into community centers. And we don't have one or two debates. You come, and we'll televise them, no editing, no nothing. And you talk to these people, and I talk to these people. You know what? Biden, in those environments, at least when he was at his intellectual heights, was really, really good. He's terrible with the script. But he's actually good talking to people one-on-one, like community, like answering a question. And that's his best bet. His greatest danger is that Trump says yes. Because Trump has a way, is really good at that too. So it's not without fault, but Biden's been almost too protected. Because Biden at his height was somebody who could go into a very difficult circumstance and get people to like him. And I give the perfect example where he's done it recently. When he went on the lines with the striking car members, and it was supposed to be a photo op, and he spent 6 hours there. And the funny thing about it is people who were deeply skeptical about him that met him suddenly were like, well, maybe he cares.
Yes, that was the 6 hours part of it was worth noting. And I felt at the time a little sympathy for his schedulers who were calling people and saying, well, I know we said the president was coming, but he's still out with the strikers. And he is the president, so he's going to stay with me as long as he wants.
Oh.
Well, that is interesting, and I think that I know we're running up on our time limitations here.
We are.
But I think that we will come back to Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72, or we're still struggling to find a name for our series, but Fear and Loathing 24 is not too far off. You know,
it's not. I mean, we're in it, but it shows that an independent African-American who's outside the system can start shifting things a lot faster than people really pretend. So on that note, by the way,
on that note, and again, if the election were held tomorrow, A, it'd be illegal, and B, everyone would be very surprised.
On that note, as always, this is Hunter Gatherers in our special series, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 72 to 22 to 24. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
The Southern gentleman hit the highway and gave us stories we could share of crooked schemes and shattered dreams of people everywhere. Road of whiskey screams and motel rooms where no one seemed to care. Road of deep, dark, secret places made us feel that we were